You're listening to one in a series of podcasts from the 2009 High Ed Web Conference in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
So, this is the first conference I've ever presented at. I have to admit that right up front. I've been to several conferences before, and I have to admit, I did have a little bit of performance anxiety. I've seen some really good presentations about some amazing topics by some amazing speakers. And due to that performance anxiety, I decided to practice my presentation another two times during lunch and to skip the keynote. So I get through my presentation once. I guess you guys already know where this is going. So the one guarantee I can make you guys, I will try to be not as bad as the keynote. Hopefully you guys will get a little bit more, Hopefully you guys will get a little bit more valuable information on my presentation. So I'm going to talk about millennials and how your best web-based project leaders are your students. Just do a few introductions. I'm the web and systems specialist for the marketing and undergraduate recruitment team at the University of Waterloo. We do all recruitment publications, websites, on and off campus events. I've been doing web design and development for about 12 years, and I really enjoy organizing disorganized workflows into efficient, cost-effective solutions. I really like taking that internal mess that we often encounter at universities and turn it into nice user-friendly formats and systems. And just going to talk a little bit about the University of Waterloo, just because it's a Canadian institution, and we realize Canadian institutions aren't necessarily always well-known in foreign places. I know the United States is a foreign place to us. Waterloo is 52 years old, and we're about an hour west of Toronto, with an undergraduate student body of about 25,000. We count in grad students and staff as well. It gets over 30,000. We start off as Waterloo College, which was an engineering school, actually in the location where Wilfrid Laurier University is right now. And back then, it was just engineering. You graduated with a degree in engineering. And co-op education, which I'm going to talk about briefly in the next slide, started back then as well. Co-op education is basically the lifeblood of the University of Waterloo, and it started with our founding. Back then, 52 years ago, men were men, women were women, and when you got a degree in engineering, you got a degree in engineering. Nowadays, from the University of Waterloo, you can get 12 specific discipline degrees in engineering, everything from systems design to comp eng to mechanical engineering, the whole gamut. But 52 years ago, you graduated as an engineer, and you got your specific specialization in the workplace, working. And they realized that one way that they could sell this brand new school a little bit better to prospective students was to create co-op, wherein you got work experience while you were studying. So we're going to just talk briefly about co-op. I'm told by our people in institutional analysis and planning that I can say that the University of Waterloo has the largest co-op program in the world. Some of our publications even say the best, although I don't know how we measure that. And basically, the long and the short of it is at Waterloo, it's an alternating four-month school semester, four-month work semester, and it's very labor-intensive. 80% of our 144 entry programs are either mandatory or optional in their co-op offerings, and 65%, almost two-thirds of our student body, is in a co-op program, and it creates a very dynamic place at the University of Waterloo. Every 4 months, if you do the math, it's about 8,000 students finding jobs, leaving campus, moving away most times, and then coming back 4 months later. And there's this constant ebb and flow, and it really shapes our culture, how we work at the University of Waterloo. For the past 5 years, we've had 95 to 99% employment rate each semester. We've done amazingly well. We have a whole building built for co-op with staff of people. All their duty is to do is to go out, build business contacts, and get jobs offered into the co-op system. We have whole staff. All they do is train students how to write better resumes and develop their interview skills, things like that. It's a really, really huge part of what we do at the university. We've had Bill Gates visit us twice. One stop, it was the only Canadian stop on one tour, and I think the second stop, he stopped at another Canadian institution, something like McGill or some school like that, I can't remember who. And the purpose of this slide isn't necessarily to sell Waterloo in our co-op program, but just more the fact that we have a very rigorous program that takes millennials and churns out extremely good employees, very intelligent students, very adaptive and creative. We have an extremely large alumni base working at Microsoft, working at RIM, working on the BlackBerry. A lot of my friends, I actually started off in mechanical engineering myself and dropped out. A lot of my friends work for RIM right now, designing the cases for the BlackBerries and things like that. So my experience with co-op and working with millennials started off very untrusting at first. When I was first hired by marketing and undergraduate recruitment, about 2 months into my position, my boss got some rare illness and was off sick. It was non-life-threatening and all that, but basically she was gone for 4 months. And here I am, guy who's been working for 2 months, barely even knows all the duties he's responsible for, barely even has enough time for the duties that he knows. And then one day someone came in and says, oh yeah, you need to hire a co-op student for next semester. And my first response was, why the hell would I want to do that? I barely have the time to manage my own priorities, let alone manage another person, give them duties, go through the whole interview and screening process. But nowadays, like, I just can't imagine not working with a co-op student today. In my group in marketing and undergraduate recruitment, we have a permanent full-time staff of 16, and we have three regular co-op position allotments. Technically, my position allotment, the technology associate, is the official job title for this position, is only supposed to be hired 2 of the 3 academic semesters, and I've been pretty good at making a case for getting them hired for the third academic semester each year. And I have a sense of anxiety. The one time that I missed out on that third semester, it was like an immediate sense of dread, like, oh my God, what am I going to do? I don't have a co-op student working with me. We rely quite heavily on them, and we pay them extremely well as well, too. So what I'll talk about today is my experience as to how to hire the right millennials, effective communication with millennials, strategies for entrusting your big projects with millennials, and we'll go through a few case histories as well, too, of some of the projects that we've had millennials work on as well. My team is a very project-oriented team, and I'll also throw in a few case histories as we go along. Yeah, it'll be posted online. It's not online yet. I want to take out the presenter notes, but I'll get up there. So, talking about how to hire the right millennials, basically you want to let them write the job description, let them write the interview questions, let them run the interview, and let them hire the student. When I say them, I mean other millennials. It's a bit of a chicken and egg scenario. If you are working in an office and you work with a millennial, someone in the age group of 15 to 25, use them. Have them go through this process. And if you don't have someone, beg, borrow, or steal. Usually there's a staff member that you're aware of or work with that has someone in that age group. You can ask for their volunteer time. A lot of kids, a lot of millennials have a very strong sense of volunteerism and are more than willing to help out with a project like this because it's pretty cool being able to hire someone. And that's usually the route that we go through. I understand at the University of Waterloo, we're really intense in our focus on millennials and the hiring process. And in some places, it's very hit or miss as to whether or not you have an opportunity to hire one. So just adapt as you will, but use a millennial to hire your millennials. So basically, in terms of letting them write the job description, position name is important. It's very key. We get tons of horror stories each semester from co-op education and career services. They're the people who run the co-op program. About students, those 1-4%, 1-5% that don't get jobs, we actually have kids that refuse to apply any jobs because the job title isn't good enough. They refuse to apply to any job that doesn't have a manager or leader. If it says something like associate or junior, they refuse to apply to it. They're very picky and they do a lot of position shopping. And sometimes that works against them. So position name is important. It's not something that will make or break a job per se, but it's a really simple thing to do that gets them more interested in your position. Duties listed are also important as well. We understand with a lot of positions for millennials, there's a lot of grunt work. It's a lot of work that no one else wants to do or just needs to get done, and you don't want to assign it to a regular full-time permanent staff member. That being said, usually what we try to do is make about 20% of their duties something cool, like a very project-focused base. And we highlight both those things in the duties listed in the job description. Highlight the grunt work so that they have a good understanding going into the job that there is going to be grunt work, but also highlight the cool projects and what they're going to get out of it as well, too. And then finally, they're better at marketing to each other than you are. We actually had a co-op student, my last co-op student by the name of Eric, is a CS student, during his job interview, flat out told us at the end of the interview that our job description was terrible. Our job description for the technology associate position was terrible. And in the job interview, he rewrote it and he said, you know, based on what you told me in the interview, this job is fantastic. I want it. But based on the job description, I applied on a whim. It wasn't that interesting to me. And what we had done is just use the standard co-op boilerplate. We took their generic job description, added our job title to it, put in the skills and duties required, and posted it live. And he basically, in the interview, rewrote it. And impressed us so much, we basically offered him the job on the spot. Technically, we're not supposed to do that sort of thing within our co-op system, but that's more or less what happened. And one of his first duties as assigned when he started in his position was to rewrite our job description. So in future years, it was exactly as he described it, and it would market a little bit better to other millennials. Yeah?
What are some position titles that...
Really, it's those adjectives we found. Like senior, manager, team lead, project manager, things like that. A lot of the time, the really undesirable ones are coordinator, which is what we had in our job description, coordinator, junior, associate, things like that. Millennials, from our research, really do have a sense of entitlement. We have built them up to believe that they're going to change the world, and by all means, they could, right? but they go into the workforce, a lot of them never having a job, and we'll talk about that briefly later on, believing that they're going to change the world, right? So you kind of have to sell them on that a little bit, kind of play the game a bit, we found. Yeah, yeah, but that being said, the junior position can still be a junior position. In the end, they're still junior positions. They're still grunt work. And they still, at heart, realize that. But there has to be that tangible benefit as well, right? You can't say it's all grunt work, right? Because you're not going to get anyone. Like, in reality nowadays, no one's going to want to apply that sort of work, right? You got to sell them on kind of the good things as well, too, but also be fair and balanced. I can't believe I just said that phrase. As a Canadian, Fox News scares me, so... Oh, good. Maybe some Americans are afraid of it, too. That's good. So, yeah. Where was I? Okay, so let them write the interview questions. Basically, they cut out a lot of fat. What we find, again, we have live in this hyper-realistic world at the University of Waterloo in terms of hiring. A lot of employers ask a lot of the same questions. And co-op students key into this and have pre-canned responses that are terrible. They don't get at the heart of what the question is asking. Things like, use three words or phrases to describe yourself. Get asked all the time. Each and every student that goes to the University of Waterloo can answer that in a split second. So they tell us basically to cut out those sorts of questions. Ask questions, or at least phrase them in a way that are a little bit more genuine and elicit better responses from them. And give them opportunities to shine as well, too. Well, another really terrible one that gets often asked in many, many interviews is the ending one would be, why should we hire you for this job? And it's a little off-putting to be asked that, kind of flat out on the spot. Why are you good enough to work here? You just rephrase that, tweak it a little bit to be a little bit more positive so that it gives them an opportunity to sell themselves. You get a much better response, much more genuine response from that sort of question as well, too. So you could rephrase that question, why should we hire you for this job? Something like, what skills or assets do you believe would benefit our team if you were working for us? A simple change of wording, right? And these kids are really good at coming up with these sorts of questions. So you let your millennial run the interview, format, direction, introductions, questions, timing, the whole nine. That being said, you just don't throw them in there and let them do it. Your role is more a role of a mentor or a guide to kind of help them through. You don't want to be, it's that balance of being too ineffectual versus being too overbearing. You don't want to give them a script to literally run the interview by. At the same time, you don't want to sit by and just say, run the interview, because they're going to crash and burn. They've never done this before. So you kind of have to act as a guide to guide them through this. And then finally, let them hire the student. They went this far. You want to give them the opportunity to make the job offer. It's a very satisfying and rewarding thing for your volunteer or for your millennial employee to make a job offer. You're affecting someone's life in a very positive way, right? You're bettering them. They get a job. They have the opportunity to make money and to afford their lifestyle, things like that. So basically, you let them lead just about every step of the hiring process. Again, if you're mentorship and leadership. And the other thing we also have to remember, too, is that hiring is a two-way street, right? We're interviewing them as much as they are interviewing us. So the way that we ask questions, the way we present ourselves is very important to millennials. So by having a millennial there with you, running most of the interview process, they're going to say, wow, like they really value them. They value their input and their skills and abilities. And if I work for them, I'm going to have the opportunity to get those same skills and abilities to interview other kids. All right. So next up, we're going to talk some effective communication with millennials. So my three recommendations, discuss your and their preferred methods of communication, have them perform a personality test or two, and share the results with each other. This is standard practice within my team, within marketing and undergraduate recruitment, with any new hire, any full-time permanent staff members. Their manager and the new hire will sit down and go through this process. And then one day we're like, we should probably be doing this with the millennials, with our co-op student hires as well, too. And so we kind of go through a little bit of a really quick process with this. But yeah, we do almost the exact same thing. Yeah. Yes, I will discuss about that. We will get to that in two slides. So preferred methods of communication, I just threw a list up there. I've had, I've had about 15 co-op students working with me under my direct supervision. I worked with about three dozen indirectly as well, too, on various projects, because we hire a lot of kids at the University of Waterloo. And I've had kids who've had each one of these preferred methods of communication. Now, you may expect with millennials that things like text messaging, instant messaging, social media sites being kind of the more popular ones, and that's true. But that's also kind of the pitfall of branding someone a millennial, right? Not everyone has that preferred method of communication. So it's important that you sit down and you discuss them. It's also important that you avoid the grumpy old man pitfall. You sit down and you say, phone is good enough for me, it's good enough for you. You need to get a hold of me, you phone. I need to get a hold of you, you phone. You answer your phone right away. And that happens. That happens more frequently than we'd like to think. So just make sure that you, too, when you sit down, you go through and you discuss your preferred methods of communication. You share yours, they share theirs, and you agree to use each other's and to respond immediately. I personally prefer email. So I'll tell my co-op student, I prefer that you email me, and if you email me, I'll respond right away. They'll tell me what they prefer, and I will use that method to get in touch with them, so long as they respond back to me immediately as well, too. Now, personality tests, which you asked about. There's two major ones that we use, Myers-Briggs and True Colors. On my team, we use Myers-Briggs quite a bit amongst the full-time permanent staff members. I have an undergraduate degree in psychology. I know all about Myers-Briggs and it being an excellent diagnostic tool, especially for interpersonal relationships. So it can be good when problems arise and you have some interpersonal staff conflict and you want to facilitate it by counseling services, and you have the two staff members write the test and discuss their feelings with each other. Not that I've ever had to go through that before. But I find that it's very long and very detailed, but there can be beneficial as well, too. Personally, the one I would recommend is the True Colors personality test typing. For those of you who may not be aware of it, there's one of four personality scales. Myers-Briggs, you can have 16. True Colors is only one of four, orange, gold, green, and blue. It's quick and dirty, but it's really, really effective. Another anecdotal story. My team used to be a part of the registrar's office, and we did the True Colors personality test as a group. There's about 80 to 100 staff all told in those two groups, and the vast majority of them, over half the registrar's office, were blue. Blue is the emotional communicators. They like to share their thoughts and feelings and things like this, and this really affected IST when they found out the results, because we use PeopleSoft on campus for our missions and tracking systems, and whenever we do rollouts, or whenever IST would do rollouts of new software and upgrades and things like that, they would always get this huge flack from the RO, and they never understood why. And it was because over half of them are the emotional communicators. You change fonts and colors and layout and things like that, they get upset. So they learned it's quite important to include them from the very beginning. You let them know when you're planning a software rollout, what changes there will be. Just kind of hold their hand through it a little bit more. And it's made the whole software update process a lot quicker and a lot easier and a lot less painful for everyone. And there's tangible benefits, not just to groups, but also individuals as well, too, by using the Myers-Briggs or the True Colors personality type as well. So it's important that you share your results. You understand that everyone has a unique communication style, and in order for two people to connect, your car is taking on the perspective of the other person. And that basically sums up generational differences. Millennials, Gen Xers, Boomers, Builders, even further back. There's that kind of psychological concept of the emotional bond that occurs between the ages of 15 to 25. Whatever's popular in culture and media, we tend to bond to a little bit more in that age range. And that kind of defines generations. My grandfather really likes the radio. He still listens to the radio for the news to this day. He has a radio collection in his basement because that was what was popular back then. My dad, it's records. Myself, it's CDs. Even though I have an MP3 collection that could kill a horse, I still can't get rid of my CDs. I have that emotional bond. I collected most of them when I was 19 years old. I can trace back memories to music in that age range. And that really sums up generational differences as well, too. Not just media, but communication styles and things like that. I suspect with millennials, we'll see social media sites will be a very important role when they're in their 40s and 50s, but they'll evolve into very different things as well, too. It'll be very interesting. So strategies for giving your millennials big projects. The biggest question I get asked is why. Why would we want to give our big projects to millennials? Basically, they can do what you do better and faster than you. I'm going to share a story about our e-newsletter for future students. It's an e-newsletter that we produce for future students, surprisingly enough, once a month. And we have always produced this thing. It's been produced since before I even started working for marketing undergraduate recruitment. And one day during a planning meeting for the next e-newsletter, one of our millennial co-op students asked, why don't we put our top 10 list in just a simple list format? It would be a lot more effective if we put it into a video format and embedded that into our e-newsletter. And we kind of sat back for a moment and we're like, hell yeah, let's do it. It's an excellent idea. There's no reason why we can't. So we set them up with a video camera, an iMac, and they edited it in iMovie. It wasn't the highest quality. It wasn't the greatest film, but they basically went out, asked a question to a whole bunch of students, got the top 10 responses, edited it down, put it into Flash video format, and we embedded it in the e-newsletter. My role as kind of facilitating all this, being the mentor and guide through it all, was to embed some tracking. So the e-newsletter before we put the video in, we put a little bit extra tracking, more than what we normally would do. And then the e-newsletters afterwards, we still have that same tracking. And our readership for our e-newsletter, just by putting in this simple little video, increased 500-fold. 500%, sorry, five times the amount. It was actually eight times the amount for that first month, and then it was a sustained five-fold increase in readership for our e-newsletter. And all we did was just add a video. We advertised the fact that it was filmed entirely by our co-op students for the millennial generation, just because we're also a little bit afraid of the quality issue as well, too. We don't want the kids, set the kids up to expect this really wonderfully produced, high-quality video. But yeah, it was, the effects were immediate and amazing. Like, just a simple change like that, and we were reaching five times the audience we had before. It just highlights the fact that they know how to communicate with each other better than we do. And there we go. So strategies for giving your millennials your big projects. I'll talk a little bit about skill building, the environment you want to set up, creating project contracts. If you attended Jesse Rogers' project management presentation, it's a very similar concept as to what he presented yesterday. And then finally, I'll talk about one major pitfall with working with millennials, or the timelines. So skill building. We've had all sorts of backgrounds. I've worked with all sorts of backgrounds in terms of our co-op students, our millennials, engineers, CS students, statistics and actuarial science, English and rhetoric, psychology. These are fairly familiar fields in web development world. By the end of their co-op semesters, each and every last one of these kids could code in at least one language, vast majority of them PHP. They could create databases in third normal form using MySQL. They could write JavaScript, and they can even do statistical analysis, F-tests, and chi-squared tests, all by the end, and be extremely proficient at it. You just have to tell them, I need you to do an F-test on our e-newsletter to see if this initiative is working out or not. I have to recommend a flexible computer. At the University of Waterloo, we have a bit of a software monoculture going on. IST only likes to support one computer type, namely Windows. So whenever you buy a new computer, it has to go through IST first. They do their whole disk image thing and get it back and can't do anything with it. We buy Macs for our millennials. Not so much the whole Mac favoritism, but more for the fact that IST doesn't maintain them and they can install anything that they want. And we've had kids that found automator scripts and things like that to quicken up a lot of our processes that we've done in the past manually and make them a lot more flexible and faster. Unhindered internet access is probably a bit of a moot point with this audience. More corporate audiences, it's actually becoming a bigger and bigger issue in Canada, and I suspect here in the States as well, too. Personal space, giving them room to work in, ideally an office just like everyone else, if you have offices, or a cubicle just like everyone else. Going back to Myers-Briggs, it gives us, the extroverts kind of a place to personalize and call their home. It gives the introverts a place to run away and hide to when they need to think about their feelings. And then finally, the most important resource is probably you. It's the one thing I always say to every boss that I've ever had is, I don't work for you, you work for me. Because when it comes down to it, any good manager only needs to do two things for their employees. It's to provide them with the resources necessary to get their job done and to eliminate any obstacles that get in the way. And I communicate that to all my co-op students, all my millennials that I have working under me. I work for them. If they are having any problems, I have to be there and available and quick to help fix it as quickly as possible. So next up, you're going to create a project charter before you hand off any big projects. So sit down with them and write it together. Basically, they write things down. Very similar to the whole concept of peer programming, but more in this case, the importance is on them typing things down, because that way they're putting down the goals of the project in their own words. It's always important that they write in their own words, because that way when they walk away from it, they know what they have to do. And that's the next point, is make sure when they walk away they clearly understand the goals and the end date. And you both sign it. And just signing it seems like such a silly thing, but it makes things so much more salient to them, right? It becomes a contract in their head. Like, I have to accomplish these goals by this date. And then next up, timelines. Biggest pitfall, probably, with working with millennials, and my biggest warning I have to give each and every last one of you. We do three major surveys of our students each and every year, one of them being the incoming student survey, where we survey all new undergraduate students coming to the University of Waterloo. A third of them have absolutely no work experience, when they begin to attend studies at Waterloo. That's a pretty big number, and it's slowly growing. We have our next incoming student survey coming out in just under a month's time, and it has increased. And even then, the two-thirds that have had work experience, it's usually very low-end remedial jobs. It's throw around, spend around the town money. Things like newspaper carrier, we actually have kids put that into resumes. Or lifeguard, things like that, which aren't really all that relevant to an undergraduate degree. And basically, the biggest pitfall we've come across is the inability to judge the length of time it's required to complete a project. Everyone likes to think they're Superman. You know, you get into a fight and you can take down six guys at once, and you get a project that's going to take you a week to accomplish it, when in reality it's probably going to take you 3 or 4 months. And that's why I recommend you come up with that project charter with the goals, so they're clear in what they have to do, but then have another meeting with them, sit down, and come up with a Gantt chart. That's another thing in Jesse's project management meeting. He kind of bashed Gantt charts. I find that they're extremely, extremely important with millennials, personally. I have to disagree with them on that one. Basically, breaking down the project into its core components kind of helps give them the realization that, well, hey, maybe this project isn't going to take me a week. I'm going to have to factor in other things like eating and sleeping and things like that. And they end up stretching it out a little bit more and gives them a little bit more of a realistic interpretation as to how long a project is going to take. There we go. And then finally, I just have to recommend that you go with the flow. You might as well give them these opportunities. Otherwise, they're going to do it themselves or criticize you on Facebook. We have a little piece of software running on UW servers. We call it the Schedule of Classes software. It's basically where you look up what classes are being offered when and being taught by which professor. This piece of software, it's a little Perl script. It's probably the cornerstone of just about every student's academic experience at the University of Waterloo. It has not changed since I was an undergraduate student, and can't even tell you how long before then it existed. So since 1997, the script has not changed. And students get frustrated with it because it's not really user-friendly or intuitive. And they've actually written mashups with it that will pull the information from the databases and actually mash it up with Rate My Prof was the last one back in 2007. So you could look up your courses, see what professors are teaching those courses, and at the same time have the rating from Rate My Prof on there as well to help you decide which class you wanted to attend, which professor you wanted teaching to you. In terms of the Facebook thing, at the University of Waterloo, we've recently undergone a rebranding process. And as part of that rebranding process, we had a new logo that we tried to implement. We're not implementing it anymore. Pew, pew, lasers, pew. It's a meme. Yeah. So the group that came up with this in communications and public affairs went through a process, and they went through a fairly collaborative process, and I think they actually had a chance of selling it at one time, but I think their biggest downfall was that they weren't as open and collaborative with our students as they could have been. They got audience feedback from about 300 people, and they probably should have rolled it out to a few more before exposing it to the wider world. Facebook group started out pretty quick. If you are on Facebook, do a search for Waterloo logo, and there's some goodness in there. I have to recommend the images section. It's full of memes and memetic goodness. It's great. Yeah. Well, that was added in. It's hard to actually... Yeah, that was... Well, during Frosh Week early September, that was how people greeted each other. Welcome to the University of Waterloo. Pew, pew, pew! It actually got old pretty quick. There's a few images with stormtroopers in them on the Facebook site. I have to recommend. It's good for a laugh. So engineers were spray painting it on the side of their cars. They built a giant effigy to it and burnt it at a fire one night. If you don't give them these sorts of opportunities, they're going to start creating them. If you go into the Facebook group, there actually is some really, really good submissions or ideas for alternate logos proposed by the students as well, too. It's quite amazing. I actually kind of wish that was the route that they had taken to the whole design process. Yeah?
You know, we
Eventually, it came around to that. Initially, it wasn't. It was a little contentious. But I really want to break it down. I'm getting a little off topic here, but I think it was a kind of a difference between industrial, the old age marketing, the Mad Men sort of marketing, versus the more social media influenced marketing. But yeah, it was an interesting time. There are a lot of hard lessons learned on all sides in the end as well, too. I have to admit that. I try to stay out of it as much as I can. But it is an excellent example of what millennials are capable of, if you upset them. So we'll talk a little bit about some case histories. One in particular, our content management system, powering our admission site at the University of Waterloo. We went through a process to reevaluate our content management system. We, once upon a time, used to have only one staff member in charge of all of our content on the admission site. It was kind of that way just because of history, and it was really hard to change it. That staff member left, and it was an opportunity for us to reevaluate and do things a little bit differently. So we entertained all options, purchase software, open source software, as well as rolling our own. We ended up rolling our own. We hired a co-op student specifically for this project. We decided this was all they were going to do for this project. This is why we were hiring them. And we based it around the tiny MCE editor and a lot of custom-written PHP scripting. And we went through the whole process. We created the project charter with them. We created the Gantt charts and everything. We decided this was going to be a semester-long project. And we'd be happy if it was just got finished, the CMS got finished, not necessarily with even all our content in it and us using it. He got it done in a month. I don't know what this kid was fueled by. He was by far the best coder we've ever had. But yeah, he gave him 3 months to improve it and do more with it. But in the end, our biggest issue, and it was a bit of a downfall, was his professionalism. Because he worked so hard, he was putting in like 12, 16-hour days sometimes. He'd come in the next day to work with bags under his eyes. In 3 separate instances, fell asleep during team meetings when the director, not even my boss, but the director of our department was speaking. One time when he was sitting directly beside her, flat out snoring. And it looked really bad. I have to admit, no, it was a really low point in my career, too, because I had to talk to him. I got scolded 3 times about it, and I had to talk to him 3 times about it before anything changed. And that's a bit of a downside to some millennials, is that they've never had that work experience before, so they don't know what is professional, what isn't, how to maintain a normal, at least somewhat healthy work-life balance. Because on occasion, we do get kids like this that will work themselves to the bone, and sometimes you have to tell them to let up. Our online forum for admitted students was run entirely by millennials. It was a marketing initiative that we used to do. We ended it about 2 years ago. Basically, it was a forum. As soon as you got admitted, you were in UW system, and you could log into this forum software and ask all sorts of questions related to the admission process and things like that. And also, it was a place for students to socialize. We found the first few years that we did it, it was an excellent tool for kids to kind of meet up before they actually moved into residence and kind of know each other's names before all the awkward introductions. And it was run entirely by millennials. They would pick up the software, they would download it, install it on the servers, they would customize the CSS, they'd get the authentication to work with the LDAP. It was fantastic. The biggest problem was, for some of them, it was a time sink. Some millennials are extremely good with social media sites. They'll use it to ask questions, find resources, help and support from their fellow millennials, and others will spend all their time there. They're the ones that have like 600 friends and post a picture of each and every last thing that they do, each and every last element of the day. And for one in particular, a young girl by the name of Mary, there was actually the cult of Mary set up around her. It also helped that she was pretty, I can admit that. And the kids quite literally worshipped her. They would ask questions directly to her, and if she didn't respond, they would get quite upset. So it ended up growing. It was initially supposed to be something that was a 15 to a half hour commitment a day, but it ended up being something that she spent like 4 or 5 hours a day doing. So it's one of those things, too. Again, there's that balance between being too overbearing and being too ineffectual. And in that case, we were too ineffectual managing her time. Chats. We have an online chat system that we use. Once we decided to eliminate the forum for admitted students, with the advent of Facebook, we saw a decrease in our usership down to 25% of the previous year's levels. We decided to eliminate the forum and go with 2 new strategies, one being a Facebook strategy and one being a chat strategy. Facebook strategy was more for the social end of our old forum, and the chat strategy was more to connect with administrators on campus and get your questions answered about the application process. And it was the first time I actually was proven wrong quite openly by a co-op student. We were entertaining, again, different pieces of software, proprietary, open source, writing stuff ourselves. And there was a proprietary piece of software that I was really pushing because I just figured it would be a lot easier to do. There would be a lot fewer headaches with IST with the install. but there was this open source piece of software that my co-op student had found, and he was quite set on getting. And he, despite the fact we had multiple meetings, and I said, no, my previous experience of IST tells me that it won't be possible for us to implement the software, he was quite persistent and got to the point where it was almost a disciplinary issue, and he stood up to me in a meeting, and it turned out I was wrong. He had actually done all the research, and it was a failure of communication on my part to actually find out that he had done all this research. And it was an excellent learning experience, too, because it also highlights the fact that they quite often know how to do your job better than you. Finally, well, I think there's one more after this. I only have 5 minutes left. We do Bayesian comment analysis, which is probably one of our favorite projects. It's really nerdy and technical. On our surveys, we do surveys for just about all of our on-campus events. I really like the open-ended questions because you get some really genuine feedback, but it's really hard dealing with all that feedback because it's just open-ended questions. You can get anything and anything written in those boxes. We had about 2 years' worth of data where we had co-op students go through and then kind of categorize each one of the comments, give them up to three different categories, and so we realized that we could set up some Bayesian filters and process these comments and create a system so that we could automatically process comments live as they're coming in, kind of like trending with Twitter, but I think a little bit more sophisticated. And this was one of those cases where we created this wonderful, really complicated technical piece of software, but I decided to go on vacation when we were going to implement it. And the co-op student put it over on the production server and put it into training mode and fired 2 years' worth of data into the system, and he crashed the production server on campus 3 days in a row. I came back from vacation. I had like an arm's length list of angry emails from IST threatening to behead me. And this kid was quite persistent, if nothing else, and uploaded the software 3 days in a row and crashed the server each one of those days. It was the server that ran like our searches and our online course software and things like that. So yeah, my big lesson from that one was be around where you're going to roll out big software written by your millennials. We already talked about the online video production. That was a part of the e-newsletter that I mentioned earlier. Finally, our virtual campus tour. It was a project. It was our first project helmed entirely by co-ops. We basically said, we need a virtual campus tour. We gave it to a co-op student to be the project lead, and had four different co-op students working on different elements of the implementation. This co-op leader was in charge of getting it done, and basically it was a huge timeline crash. We expected it to be done in 4 months. And when we look back on this project, it's up and running now. Only took us an extra year. When we look back on this project now, we realized that we didn't really have a system to turn co-ops into project managers. They can be project leads. They can get stuff done with your oversight and help, of course. But in terms of getting them to be project managers, that's a whole other level. And basically what I just presented to you today with is what we go with them now. Whenever we want a co-op student to be a project manager, they have to go through, sit down with the other co-ops that they're working with, do the personality testing, come up with project charters, the whole nine, and we've avoided a lot of pitfalls as a result. So yeah, that's it. I know time's running out. Do we have any questions or anything? There's been a few during the presentation. Yeah. At any given time? In my office, marketing undergraduate recruitment 3. There's a technology associate, communications associate, and a visitor center associate. Not use you as a therapist? In all honesty, that's sometimes, I think, the role of a good manager. And it's hard to account for it, because in reality, there are, like I said, with the personality typing, you could use that as a bit of a warning. Like, blues and introverts can cause problems. There's nothing wrong with being a blue or an introvert, but sometimes those sorts of people need to talk about their feelings and emotions, and you're going to have to plan that into your workflow. That being said, yeah, there's no way you're going to be able to get around it sometimes, because it's also due to politics. We all work in academic institutions, and politics are king, and there can be instances where people act inappropriately, and there's really nothing you can do about it but talk about it.
Thank you.
It'd probably come down more to marketing the position, selling them on the really really good duties. Again, being honest and saying there is some grunt work, but yeah, I'd say I'd recommend for those positions that you make sure that each one of them have something really cool that they can put on the resume, and you highlight the fact that this is something that's really cool that will you can put on your resume and that will get you employed by future employers. In terms of the other approach, too, would be to find a way to increase your funding for to hire millennials. I know. In our case, in particular, in marketing undergraduate recruitment in our visitor center, we used to have two full-time permanent staff members there. One of the two positions, really, it wasn't necessary that it would be a full-time position, so we waited until the person left. Because in that position, the people would normally stay for like a year, year and a half tops before they'd move on to greener pastures. And as soon as the last person left, we eliminated the position and the salary associated with it. And it made it for a much easier argument for us to get three permanent co-op positions on our team as well, too. Sorry. We have each student for 4 months. Co-op system strongly encourages them to return to a job for another 4 months if they can. Very few students actually do it in reality, we find, just because they just like to try a little bit of everything. One of the big selling points of our co-op system is that you can find which jobs you like and don't like. That being said, in terms of training, it usually takes us a week. In all honesty, it's a week from start to finish that they're up and running and ready to do it. They may not be the most proficient at it. They'll get better as the semester goes by. But really, the vast majority of the hand-holding takes place over the course of the week. Yes? No. It is an option within the co-op system. You can limit it to various years. We don't, though. And I have to admit, some of our best workers, it doesn't really depend upon the year. Per se, I actually find there's a bit of a correlation with the discipline they're in. Engineers work extremely, extremely well, very proficient. But that's just, I don't know, my own personal. We have sometimes the opposite effect, though, too. Like sometimes they'll take our job because it's admittedly our positions are seen as a little bit lower tier. But they take it because they want to have fun with it, right? And that's where we get some of the most creative ideas, too, is from those kids, those up-year kids that just want to have fun with the position. Yes? Sorry, I don't fully understand your problem.
Okay.
No. Please try to explain a little bit more. Yeah. Maybe. Like, are you working towards, like, finding, you know, more office space and things like that for them? Are you communicating that to them? Things like that.
We are told to mentor these kids and teach them, and of course, we're told it's not going to be as professional.
Yeah, naturally.
But we're being evaluated on their work. They want us to make it look professional. But it's not fair because I'm supposed to do my job and make it look as professional as possible at the same time. It's just kids, and their work is not as professional. So this is tight. We don't have that balance.
Yeah, in all honesty, it sounds like you guys are being overmanaged too much, and I can't really give you a suggestion as to how to improve that. Personally, it would just be a matter of working the systems as best you can, right? Like, if you can cheat a little bit, beg, borrow, or steal is a lot easier to ask for forgiveness than it is for permission. But still, like, I guess basically what you have to do is at least communicate to the co-op students, you know what, hey, things aren't going to be perfect, but we're working on doing things better. And give them the opportunity to help you out, provide you with suggestions and things like that, and that'll go a lot further with them. In terms of dealing with your boss, who may be expecting a certain level of productivity, I would recommend get them to manage a student directly, right? Like, in all honesty, like, that's the best experience for a lot of people, is to go through it themselves and see just how much work and how difficult it can be, and hopefully their expectations will change with that as well, too.
Just kind of on that, because it's really interesting that I have experienced a lot of the same stuff that you have. It's really hard at the very beginning to empower them. Really hard, like, because you can see some of the, oh, you're not doing this the way that I do it, or maybe it could be a little more professional or whatnot. But then I think it has a lot to do with just the initial selection of the first students. Because when I first, the first year I tried it, it was awful. I had a couple really good. Next year I did it, I used the good students to help bring in more good students, and it got a lot better. And now it's just like students, you know, I've got like the best people I can probably have, where I just want more of them. So maybe it's just the initial selection of students that might be that you might want to get more into.
I would agree with that, because a slacker is a slacker no matter how old he or she is.
Yeah.
You know, so getting the right person, like, you know, we only have 4 months, it's a little different, but, you know, we basically have worked for 4 years, but, you know, it's only 2 weeks now, so fine, week. What we usually do is we put a lot of upfront time into kind of early mentorship and being really available, like really, really available, and on trivial little projects that to us are trivial, but we're still trying to, you know, have high expectations within those projects. And then oftentimes within that process, we get a sense, yeah, is this person, are they getting traction? Is this stuff working? If not, usually we end, like, things end pretty amicably, and they go off and work for some other parts of college, you know.
All right, that's it. I'm told I have to cut it. So thank you. You can connect with me all these different ways. I also want to thank our Hi-Ed Web people for facilitating today. This was the last session. Save the best for last, hopefully, when you fill out your time. So I would just like if we could give our sponsors today a nice round of applause.